Chesney is next.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today, on July 24th, 2005, coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign here in beautiful Urbana. And it's a live show on WILL AM 580. Today, we're going to be talking about whiteness, white supremacy, the chief, the controversial symbol of the University of Illinois, and last and certainly not least, the effort to weed out left-wing and liberal professors from college campuses, including the University of Illinois. To take on that broad summary of tasks, we have a wonderful guest for you, Professor David Roediger of the History Department here. So please join us for Media Matters today. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Whatever happened to the outrage against fake news? Earlier this year, the FCC and Congress both admonished the widespread use of audio and video news releases in broadcast newscasts. ANRs and VNRs are produced by both government and corporate America in order to shill specific points of view, but to do it in such a way as to make the public think the information they're getting is legitimate journalism. The controversy over fake news got so hot that a bill called the Truth in Broadcasting Act was introduced in the U.S. Senate that would require all audio and video news releases to be labeled as pseudo-news. But high-power lobbyists hired by MediaLink, one of the country's largest producers of audio and video news releases, looks like they'll succeed in blunting the Truth in Broadcasting Act. For a while, ANRs and VNRs will have to be labeled for what they are. The bill's been stripped of a provision that would require radio and TV stations to actually air the disclosures themselves. That will allow the current practice of excerpting soundbites from such releases to continue, making the public none the wiser.
Congress is moving closer to mandating a date when television makes the official switch from analog to digital broadcasting. Many stations already broadcast both an analog and digital signal, and the government would like to reclaim the analog spectrum and devote it to other services. One of those would be public safety. Harlan McEwen with the International Association of Chiefs of Police says first responders desperately need more radio spectrum to make their own communication networks more reliable, and they've been waiting almost a decade for it.
In 1996, a Blue Ribbon committee determined that public safety agencies did not have sufficient radio spectrum to do their jobs. Congress responded in 1997 by directing the FCC to reallocate 24 megahertz of spectrum for public safety services. Unfortunately, public safety spectrum continues to be blocked. In the meantime, the public safety spectrum needs identified in 1996 have worsened, especially since 9/11.
The problem with making the digital television transition is that current analog TV sets will not receive the new signals unless they're supplied with a converter box to translate the digital signal. Gene Kimmelman, director of the D.C. Office of Consumers Union, says without a converter, those TV sets will become obsolete overnight.
More than 16 million households get their television service over the air. When you cut off the analog signal, those television sets will not work. We find that there are as many as 45 million additional sets that consumers say are not used for DVDs, are not used to play games, that are used to receive over-the-air signals in addition to their cable and satellite hookups. Those analog sets will also go black.
Currently, the regulatory logjam in the DTV transition is how to help those whose TV sets will go dark at the time of the transition itself, currently scheduled for 2009. Congress is mulling over some sort of subsidy program whereby low-income Americans can receive assistance for the purchase of TV converter boxes. Kimmelman says now is the time for letting the public know what's on the horizon.
I don't believe the American people have any idea what is being discussed and the significance of it and what it'll mean for them. And so there are a lot of pieces that have to come together for people to be able to feel comfortable with changing how they receive signals on their television set and knowing how much it's going to cost them.
When the switch does take place, there will be lots of analog TV spectrum free to use for other services besides public safety. Public interest groups, including Consumers Union, are pushing for some of that spectrum to be devoted to a kind of open space where developers of new, affordable wireless broadband delivery systems can innovate. Any auction of the analog TV spectrum is expected to raise at least $30 billion.
And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. The United States is spending more money in Iraq to push propaganda than to empower a free press. Three companies have been hired by the U.S. military to not only put a positive spin on news overseas, but also to produce full-length radio and TV programs, pro-U.S. websites, and even novelty items like bumper stickers and T-shirts. It's expected that up to $100 million will be spent on these efforts over the next 5 years. This is on top of the $40 million per year that the United States spends sponsoring the Al-Hura satellite TV network. Meanwhile, real journalists in Iraq face near-constant threats of expulsion or worse from occupying forces and the Iraqi police and military for trying to tell the truth. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today, July 24th, 2005, coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We got a live in-studio guest, a rarity for us here at Media Matters, where we usually use the telephones to get our guests, but a terrific guest at that. David Roediger, the chair of the History Department at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, well-known to many of our listeners. Also on the, let's see, the what other department are you in, David?
African-American Studies.
African-American Studies. And
I'm, in fact, not chair of history.
That you aren't.
A mistake on the book jacket.
Were you thrown out or?
No.
Never got put in, huh?
I have an endowed chair. And
you have an endowed?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I apologize. I thought that was too good to be true. Nothing against your current chair in the history department, but thanks for correcting me there. And anyway, with an endowed chair in the history department at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, a very well-known author on issues of race and class in the United States, one of the leading historians in the United States on those subjects, who's written several very important books, including The Wages of Whiteness, and has a brand new book out that we're going to talk about on this program, along with a number of other issues. The book is called Working Toward Whiteness, How America's Immigrants Became White, published by Basic Books. And when did it come out, babe?
Just about 3 weeks ago.
So it is literally hot off the presses. And folks, if you want to call in and ask a question to Professor Roediger or have a comment, the number here, as always, 333-9455. And the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. For starters, you know, the book jacket says that you're one of the leaders or the leading figures who has brought attention to the notion of whiteness. And you hear this term a lot in academic circles, but not very much elsewhere. Could you explain what that term means and why it's important?
Yeah, I think what people are talking about is the critical study of whiteness now. Really just involves making white identity into a problem so that for a historian, you'd say, what if whiteness were a historical problem? When did it happen? Why did it happen? What were the implications of it happening? You could think about whiteness as a political problem. You could think about it as a moral problem. And there's a tremendous tradition of doing this in African-American studies and in Latino studies. In other words, for peoples for whom whiteness presented itself as a problem, there was always this scholarship, this wondering about what it means to be white, when whiteness happened, why whiteness happened. But in the mainstream of academia, and as you say, in the street, whiteness just seems so natural in the United States and so unproblematic to whites through most of history that it's never been really taken up in the way that people have talked about the black problem the race problem always means people of color and not whites.
You know, this book really opened my eyes as I was reading it over the weekend, Working Toward Whiteness, your new book. And it reminded me, in an earlier life, I was a great baseball fan. And I was reading a detailed biography of Mickey Mantle many years ago. And it had his original scouting report. Mantle was being scouted in high school in Oklahoma by the Yankee scout who eventually signed him. And it was an official report. It was very interesting because it had one of the lines on it was race. Hmm. And I thought at the time, that's it. Maybe they want to weed out to make sure they don't let any black players in the majors because this was like 1947 or Robinson had just come in for the Dodgers. But under it, it said English and Irish. And clearly it was to identify race. And the term you talk about it and the transition that's made – from the 1890s, the massive wave of immigration, to the end of the Second World War. And, you know, so there was a different sense of what race meant. It's changed considerably. That's a lot of what this book is about.
Yeah, we tend to think about groups now, like the English and Irish, like Italians, as being ethnic groups, and sometimes maybe the term white ethnic gets used as a descriptor. In the actual lived history of the early 20th century, when immigration was at its height from Europe, that term ethnicity was not used, and there was no such term until the 1960s.
Yeah, I just want to interject. When I was reading your book, that was striking to me, because I came of age in the 60s and hearing the term white ethnics all the time by the late 60s. I assume this was like in the Constitution or something.
Yeah, it's a 64, I think, is thought to be the first usage of it. And so what it means is that for Italians who came to the United States in the early 20th century heard about the Italian race, and in fact heard about two Italian races, the South Italian, closer to Africa, inferior supposedly, than North Italian, Alpine. So there were Slavic races, there were Polish races, there were all of these intra-European racial divisions, which left those groups not non-white. They weren't in the same position as Jim Crowed African Americans or as excluded Chinese immigrants, for example, but not fully white either. And so this book is the history of 10 million people's and their children attempts to learn about the racial system in the United States and to fit themselves into it.
And, you know, why those years? Why 1890 to 1945? I think you call that, you quote some other historian, the early long century?
The long early 20th century. Yeah. Well, I started out to try to write the history of these various immigrant groups, and I ended up, and race, and I ended up thinking that in many ways, this is the history of the early 20th century in the United States. The fact that immigration changed about 1890, becoming more from Southern and Eastern Europe, the less developed sectors of Europe, and less from Northern and Western Europe, and then that those peoples and their children who came in tremendous, tremendous numbers, who completely remade the working class in the United States and the factories, were the objects of progressive reform. So that's how we understand progressivism. They were the object of a 5-million-member Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s and of immigration restriction. And then most controversially, I think the book argues that they were also the backbone and beneficiaries of the New Deal, so that the major events politically in U.S. history in the early 20th century, the long early 20th century, are then tied to the presence of what people at the time called new immigrants. New meaning not only recently arrived, but from a new area, from Southern and Eastern Europe.
We're talking to Professor David Roediger today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show, so if you'd like to call in with questions or comments, the phone number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We're talking about David Roediger's brand new book, just published, Working Toward Whiteness, How America's Immigrants Became White. Later in the program, we will be discussing the controversy surrounding the chief as the insignia or representative or emblem or logo of the University of Illinois, and also the effort by some to weed out left-wing faculty or to balance them with conservative or right-wing faculty so that students, in their view, get a more balanced education, and take that issue up with Professor Roediger, who's given all these issues considerable thought. Following up on the last point, David, how important is the labor movement? Because you really, really, in a way, are a labor historian as well. How important is the labor movement, which really boomed in the 1930s and into the 40s and was central to the notions we have of the New Deal, to this sort of definition of whiteness?
Well, I think it's very important. In the early 20th century, when unions were organized based on skill and literally based on trying to exclude people from your skill, a kind of a reflex of those craft unions was to exclude not only African Americans and Latinos, but also new immigrants, non-citizens, Eastern and Southern Europeans. So only in the teens, really, were there efforts to build multiracial unions in the sense of including Italians or including Jews, Eastern European Jews, for example. So those kinds of initiatives failed. They failed in the face of immigration restriction. They failed when strike waves were defeated. But they got resuscitated in the 1930s and succeeded in the CIO in the New Deal. And in many ways, the CIO was a triumph of multiracial unity among whites. It did, at its tail end in the 1930s, bring in significant numbers of black workers. But its original triumph and what made it different from the defeated union movement of the teens and early 20s was that it was able to build a multiracial alliance, as people thought of race at that time, among Eastern and Southern Europeans, along with longer-arrived immigrants.
So a notion of common ground among the various Eastern and Southern European immigrants who previously had been sort of segregated and...
Yeah, and the CIO becomes a great vehicle for civil rights struggle for Eastern and Southern Europeans. So people take the CIO to mean, take the fact that they have a strong union, for example, in steel mills, to mean that they won't be called hunky anymore, that they won't be referred to by these racial slurs, that foremen will have to use their names, that they won't have to, that they or their kids won't have to change their names in order to get skilled jobs, that not so much the top leadership, but the secondary leadership of the unions themselves will now all of a sudden be open to people like them. So in many ways, the CIO is the realization of full industrial citizenship, Far Eastern and Southern Europeans particularly.
Now, one of the themes that runs through the book, and I don't want to, listeners, but I assure you we're not going to go into too much detail here. We're going to get at the big issues involved. But this is a big issue today, which is immigration law. One of the themes that runs through your book is sort of debates over immigration law and immigration reform. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, between 1890 and 1920, there was a massive immigration from, as you said already, everyone knows, from Eastern and Southern Europe. And then there were strict limits put on immigration in the 20s that really held up for about 4 or 5 decades before they were relaxed. What was behind that, and how did that have changed things? I mean, if they hadn't had those limits on immigration, what would have been different?
Well, the immigration restrictions of the 1920s originally took the 1890 U.S. nation as the ideal U.S. nation.
In terms of ethnic balance.
In terms of ethnic balance, and said that's how we'll set limits for the future as well, ignoring the influx of Eastern and Southern Europeans. The real immigrants of the last 30 years get disappeared from U.S. history by this formula, and different formulas end up being used. But the result is a literal decimation in the levels of peoples from Eastern and Southern Europe who can come, so that these communities, which were constantly having newcomers, which were constantly having people going back and forth to Europe, so-called birds of passage, which had political ideas passing back and forth, which preserved foreign languages because there was so much new life being brought into these communities, now all of a sudden that's impossible. And it also changes progressive reformers because they had kind of lost faith in open immigration by the early 20s and more or less sat out the struggle to keep immigration open. And then with the decimation of immigrant levels, all of a sudden the progressive reformers say, well, we couldn't cope with 1 million Italians, but 50,000 Italians we can assimilate. We can reform. So there become these new expectations that assimilation, 100% Americanism, is going to happen real fast to a small number, a relatively small number of people.
We're talking to David Roediger today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live on WILL AM 580. The phone lines are open if anyone's interested in calling in with a question or comment. The number here, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. David Roediger is the author of the brand-new book, Working Toward Whiteness, How America's Immigrants Became White, just published 3 weeks ago by Basic Books. He's one of the leading scholars on this subject in the United States today, and he's in the history department here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and in the African-American Studies Department as well, if I've got that right. You know, what are the political implications of your work for someone who, you know, isn't especially concerned with U.S. history? What do we learn? What insights do we gain on the current situation in this country from work like this?
Well,
or do you hope we learn?
Yeah,
let's say.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I was impressed with in doing this research is how vitally important housing is in the history of immigration, Eastern and Southern European immigration to the United States. At that moment in the 20s that we were talking about, when there's immigration restriction, and it's immigration restriction, frankly, based on racism against Eastern and Southern Europeans, low IQ scores, mm-hmm. unfit for ruining the nation. The Klan has 3 to 5 million people in its enrolled membership at the time. At that very same moment that that brutality was being committed against Eastern and Southern Europeans, in cities in the north in the United States, there was an attempt to create all-white neighborhoods through restrictive covenants. And those same Eastern and Southern Europeans were brought in to those restrictive covenant campaigns as white. So on the one hand, at the national level in Congress, people were saying, you're not Americans, you're not white, you're not fit. And at the local level, people were saying, around our investment in housing, around our animosity to African Americans in neighborhoods, you're completely white. Mm-hmm. And so there's a tremendous drama in the 20s being played out there. And immigrants are big homeowners. Working class immigrants own homes in U.S. cities as much as middle class, long established people.
It's a big deal.
They sacrifice to own homes. And so around that acceptance through home ownership and investment in home ownership, there becomes this tremendous sense that the home is the source of wealth. And in doing that, we create this, the New Deal then subsidizes the home loans for those white citizens. And much, much, George Lipsitz's work reflects this, of the levels of inequality, about $8 or $9 of wealth held by a white family compared to a black family on average in the United States today, much of that goes straight back to this discrimination in housing and this process through which new immigrants demanded and the New Deal state provided white housing for them.
We're talking to David Roediger. We've got some callers I'm going to get to. If you'd like to call in and join us, the number again, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to line one. Urbana, you're on the air with Professor David Roediger.
Yes, hi. This is just a couple of comments regarding whether there are liberal professors or conservative professors on our campuses. Well, frankly, I just feel that the faculty at the university needs a free enema. Like, they just need one, desperately need one, because it's not whether you're liberal or conservative. It's just how useful you are to the society you live in. Mm. It seems to me that topics such as what you're discussing today, in terms of, it always begins with a book. Even if you go to a class, it begins with a book that they wrote. So are they relevant to our society? The election that was just held that brought Mr. Bush to power clearly shows how shamefully irrelevant they are. Mm. You know, it is one thing to live in our Cherry Hills paradise and come to class and lecture students on class warfare. See, whenever I go to a class, that person is in the upper crust of Champaign-Urbana, in my opinion, anyway. Mm. And so how useful are these topics to our society? And so to me, it's not whether liberal or conservative. In my opinion, although some professors genuinely, I don't mean to trash professors, genuinely believe in what they're doing, I applaud that. But there's a larger problem of classism, snobbery, elitism, you know. And so as long as those things are not addressed, I believe, unlike other countries in Europe where intellectuals play a vital role in any sort of social revolution, if you want to call it, I just feel the Champaign-Urbana faculty just are absent. And so this is just a commentary.
Well, thank you very much, caller.
Yeah, I'd like to respond to it. I have actually been thinking about what the effect in this society of having such a large university left liberal tradition now compared to social movements. And I think that I wouldn't phrase it as the caller did, but I think there's something to that we do sometimes pay for having so intellectual a left, if you can even call it a left, in this country, and that the comparisons to Europe are useful comparisons. Although, for me, the comparison would be that many of the European nations have managed to sustain social movements that are greater than in the United States. And so there's a place for intellectuals to go where they're not just talking about their own books or their own intellectual production. They actually are in movement and are learning from large masses of people. So I think that more is the difference that I would see. I also would say that there that sometimes books do have a contribution to make to the kind of political questions we're asking. The caller mentioned the election. And the election, one of the striking facts about the last election to me was how fully racialized the vote was. 89% of African Americans voting against Bush. But more importantly, 63% of white men voted for Bush in this election. The predictor, the white male predicted a Bush vote as well as a $200,000 a year salary predicted a Bush vote. So that when you begin to look at those kinds of demographics and voting patterns, it becomes clear that class is tremendously important, but so is this kind of racialized class. Mm-hmm. So that some very wealthy African Americans are still voting against Bush, and some white men in particular with nothing are, and this is what Tom Frank's book about Kansas is about, very poor white people who still on, I think, largely racial bases identify with power.
So you think that, to follow up on this point, because I think it grows right out of this book and in the whole trajectory of your work, that white people, working class, lower middle class, people who sociologically would not necessarily have any great affinity with the policies being pursued by the Bush administration for racial reasons and racial identity and racist reasons. Mm-hmm. Say, well, this is my, I'm going to throw in with these guys.
Yeah, and I mean, sometimes I think it's important to say racial and racist. Sometimes they're not what we would call fire-eating racist reasons. They're, the fact is that this society trains white people to identify with other white people and to see their interests and their bodies and themselves as being part of this, what I would say is a political alliance called the white race. And for a few people, that delivers a lot of privilege and benefits. For a lot of white people, it doesn't deliver much property. But in a sense, then, their whiteness becomes their property and their thing that they can bank on and hope for and wish would lead to something good. And so I think that there's a tremendous political utility in surfacing this pattern and saying, well, why is it that so overwhelmingly white men in particular vote Republican now?
We're talking to David Roediger here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone numbers, if you want to call in, 333-9455, the toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. We've got a few patient callers. Let's get back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Professor David Roediger.
Yes, I kind of want to, I had another question in mind, but I want to follow up with the last caller. I do believe that even though you know, public universities like the University of Illinois have outstanding scholars, and I'm not going to get into whether they're liberal or progressive or conservative, and there's a balance. But I do believe there's a sense within people, including, say, North Champaign and North Urbana, which are predominantly black. I understand from recent Urban League statistics, maybe 70% of the African-American community in this region is below poverty level. They sense that whether the professors are black, Hispanic, Caucasian, Latino, polka dot, that there's this intellectual snobbery whereby the resources of that university are never brought to bear to deal with their real problems, and that it's just a mountain of resources that's an island from what really goes on in the real world. And I don't believe that's simply a view unique to this Midwestern community or any community that has a large university like that. I believe many believe that the scholarship that is generated there is for scholars to talk about, as this show highlights, or to sit idly on a shelf and accumulate dust in a major library. And I think that until the universities understand that they have a calling to use their expertise to deal with racism, classism, sexism, whatever ism we're talking about in a real-world context, as opposed to theoretical notions, you're just going to be subject to this backlash in our society. That's my point.
Well, thank you very much, caller. David, if I can add to that, then I want your response. It seems like there's sort of a couple of different things going on for professors and academics in universities. On one hand, we're supposed to be, especially here at Land-Grant University, doing service to the public, of research that locks into issues to the general public, and we're supposed to be working to solve those problems in a way I think the caller would like to see. On the other hand, the university community and structure is very much to discourage that, to promote elitism, arrogance, that, you know, and I think a lot of the current political efforts that we're going to talk about, the right-wing efforts, to discourage professors from doing connecting their work to broader communities outside the campus. I mean, there seems to be a real tension there, and you can't have both, can you?
Yeah, and it's a very difficult set of issues. I directed for 2 years in the recent past the Center on Democracy in a Multiracial Society, and one of our mandates and passions was to try to move scholarship off campus and to get it into the community. And we had some success. We had, I think, very, very good success around some anti-death penalty work that we did, and a wonderful conference on prisons and schools that drew a lot of people from the community and had some ongoing echoes. But as Bob says, you know, that's something that I can do as a professor who's been around for a long time and who's written some books. But the real currency in universities is articles and books and, in some fields, grants. And those are not the kind of things that the kind of outreach community work that the caller wishes that there were more of are not the kind of things that the university by and large regards when it makes decisions about tenure and other matters. So the one point I would make is that as a member of the faculty in African American Studies, I think that there's some really great forward motion on the part of that unit. And I'm thinking about Will Patterson's work in the community, and I'm thinking about work around police brutality and bringing students and community members together around police brutality. So I think that obviously there's not enough, and we also ought to not just think about Champaign and Urbana. I mean, Decatur's part of Illinois and Danville's part of Illinois. There's a good outreach project in East St. Louis. But in general, the university's not a presence in cities, and that's lamentable.
You know, David, I was reading one of your papers that was emailed to me by our producer, Andrew Boyle, a couple of days ago, and it talked at the end of the paper, it was just a short paper, about enrollment levels for students of color at the University of Illinois, and they dropped sharply for this particular year, I think this year, not just African-American, but Native American and Latino American. I mean, just it was striking. I mean, massive percentage drops. And I mean, I didn't realize that, to be frank, that it was so striking. What's going on here?
Well, it seems to have bounced back again this year. And some administrators and some people who have been thinking about it think that going to online applications may have had a discriminatory effect for 1 year, and that process has gotten better, and maybe computer access has gotten a little bit better, and the university's outreach was better. But even the kind of baseline figure is about half of what it should be in terms of what the state looks like, people of color in the state, students of color in the state versus students of color who make it here. One reason I emphasize that in that paper is that it was at the end of a year in which we here on campus had celebrated lavishly the Brown versus Board desegregation decision. And I was part of the celebration, part of planning it. And it was a very self-congratulatory celebration. And then the irony is that at the end of that year, we see this tremendous drop in African-American student enrollment. And so I think we need to think about those dynamics. I was just gave a talk at the Brown versus board, a national park that has just come up in an urban park in Topeka, Kansas, a couple weeks ago. And the T-shirt that they gave me when I spoke there said, Brown versus Board 50, 2005. And usually people think of it as 50 in 2004. The decision, the first decision was in 1954. And that's what gets celebrated because it's an inclusive, liberal decision. There was a 2005 jubilee. There was a 1955 Brown decision, which denied enforcement of Brown, which was a terrible decision. And nobody's celebrating that. Nobody's trying to come to grips, except those folks in Topeka and a very few others, trying to say, what did Brown 2 mean in terms of setting up a university system which is pledged to, a school system which is pledged to racial equality, but doesn't really expect it to happen anytime soon, because that's what the court decision in 1955 said.
We've got a couple of callers who are waiting very patiently. I'll get to them in a second, but I want to follow up on this enrollment question. When you factor in class and the economic background of students, I mean, public universities like this one have increasingly become much more middle and upper middle class, from my experience, over the since I went to college in the early 70s. If you factor in class, does that explain a lot of the disparity here? Or, I mean, how much is, you know, if you can look at the, because, you know, the African-American population, as one of the callers pointed out, is predominantly poor. Well, poor people just in general aren't going to the University of Illinois. How much of this is class, and how much is, do you think we can say this is just really a race-based phenomenon?
Well, I think we can see that it's about both race and class by looking at the students of color who do come, too. And my friend Jim Anderson in the education school emphasizes that the students that we do attract of color from the Cook County area tend to be suburban students, tend to there's still very little success growing, but little at getting into the inner city schools and attracting students from there. And that, I think, is about class.
Yeah. We're talking to David Roediger today, our guest on Media Matters. He's in the history department at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and the author of the brand new book, Working Toward Whiteness, How America's Immigrants Became White. If you'd like to call in, the phone number here is 333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And now we're going to turn to the most patient caller in many weeks on Media Matters. Line 4, Indiana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with David Roediger.
Hello. Well, you certainly have my patience in any program because it's excellent. I keep up the books and monographs in particular. The next thing is during my period in school, I almost went to the New School for Social Research in New York City simply because of their activity within the different boroughs and trying to bring a more liberal perspective to the poor and, basically the used. My question, unfortunately, is not particularly important, I think, in the scheme of things, but I hope it's germane in some way. I collect movies from the 30s and 40s, and especially in the 30s, there were a phrase that was often used by white girls. It was that, I'm white, free, and 21. I just wondered from your perspective in studying about this general notion of whiteness, was there anything going on then that would make the writers put this in a number of movies or something along those lines? That's something I've been trying to find out for years, and I was hoping that through your knowledge you might be able to put some light on, in fact. Thank you.
What an interesting question.
Are you familiar with that line?
Yeah. Okay. The phrase itself is a 19th century phrase, and it kind of rattles around in U.S. culture and popular culture. But it's interesting that the caller and viewer identifies it as a particularly 1930s thing on film, because I think that part of what happened in the 30s is that Jewish and, to a certain extent, Italian filmmakers and Irish censors got power in the movie industry in a way that made film very cognizant of an ethnic audience. It always had been cognizant of an ethnic audience, but of the second generation of that audience fitting in as Americans and, to some extent, fitting in as white Americans. The book that we're talking about today ends with a chapter on a film, on a pro-World War II propaganda film with Frank Sinatra called The House I Live In. And that film was made, won a special Oscar in 1945 and was made with government approval by Jewish and Italian an Italian star and Jewish filmmakers, and that it could be so, and almost all of them around the Communist Party, radical actors and directors and songwriters. And that stands in such strong contrast with the persecution of immigrants in World War One. Those groups that were spied on and eventually had their immigration right to immigrate removed during and after World War One. By World War Two, Sinatra and Jewish filmmakers could be the very epitome of pro-Americanism.
Yeah, it's really striking.
It's a very, very rapid transformation. And part of, I think, what the caller's question gets at is that the film industry itself had a role in that transformation. There are little hints of it in the book. The book was originally called White Houses, and one of the chapters has a section that talks about whether the movie house was a White House and the transition from trying to make films that would specifically appeal to an Italian-American audience that maybe were about Italy partly, to trying to make the sort of films that have these young second-generation ethnic women that the caller's talking about, who are now saying, I'm free white and 21, rather than saying, I'm Italian.
Yeah. We're talking to David Roediger. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with David Roediger.
Yes, thank you. referring back to an earlier caller who introduced the issue of class, I think that, well, class is one of those things here in America where we're loath to bring that into the analysis of racism or anything else. But I think that it's that ruling elites have found for a long time have used racism as a means of control, and it's been very useful to them. And as far as the, you know, ineffectiveness of intellectuals in this country, I think that, you know, in Europe, they have two huge advantages we don't have here. One, they have a much more diverse and open media that has much wider terms of debate than the mainstream media in this country do. And also they have most of the countries have some sort of parliamentary system that allows by minority viewpoints to at least get, a voting voice in the political process. Where here, it's winner-take-all kind of thing, and you don't have a chance for smaller factions to get political representation. And also, and this is sort of along a little different line, but a movie that I think has a really, you know, sort of wonderful analysis of racism that came out, I guess, the 60s or early 70s, but Blazing Saddles. I mean, they takes up a lot of the issues you're talking about here. I remember one scene vaguely where they're trying to decide who all they're going to let in, and the last group. I mean, okay, we'll let the blacks in, we'll let the Jews in, but the Irish, they were hesitating on that. So, okay, we'll let them in too.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, caller. David, do you have any particular comment you'd like to make on that? Or?
No, I think the points are well taken, particularly the European comparisons are well taken.
What about the question he raises of media and media discussion of race? I know that you know, this is something you've been interested in on talk radio locally. But in general, if you could make some observations about how race is dealt with in sort of everyday media parlance, so the sort of the exposure people get to discussions of racial issues in this country, you know, how would you assess it?
Well, the research I've been doing, if you can call it that, it involves listening to the radio, is largely about sports talk radio and political talk radio. I grew up in St. Louis around KMOX, the giant radio station that once had a 20 share of the audience in St. Louis. And it was the fountainhead of sports talk radio. But also then of political talk radio. And some of the people that were famous Hall of Fame broadcasters like Jack Buck are known as baseball broadcasters, but were also the precursors of Rush Limbaugh. And I'm very interested in this connection between what I consider to be one of the most democratic forms in American society, that is sports talk radio, where you can find all sorts of opinions being expressed and lots of different viewpoints and interesting observations about race always on sports talk radio. And then it's transmutation into political talk radio where that variety is shut down and it becomes more or less a right-wing phenomenon.
So, what sort of stuff do you hear in sports talk radio that, you know, sort of, you know, give an example, if you would, of that?
Oh, I mean, for example, if Latinos in the Hall of Fame, with Palmeiro's just getting his 3,000th hit, the discussion about whether he's a Hall of Famer or not will always, I mean, I don't always listen to small markets, but in Chicago and in Minneapolis anyway, that will always lead to a very deeply historical, because sports fans are very, very deeply historical people, reflection on, well, who are the people who have been on the border but haven't made it into the Hall of Fame, and why is that? And then a curiosity about the difference between acceptance or rejection of African Americans and Latinos in baseball and the trajectory of that history. So, when Flip Saunders just got named the Pistons head coach after total failure as the Timberwolves, the Minnesota head coach.
Well, total failure might be a...
I'm a Timberwolf fan.
An editorial opinion.
But the idea of who gets to coach and race and coaching will then spawn really sophisticated debates. And, you know, they won't by any means all be anti-racist opinions expressed, but there'll be this back and forth in a way that you just never feel as you're listening to Rush Limbaugh, that there's a back and forth that's not already plotted out so that you know what the liberal opinion is going to be isolated and ridiculed. And
yeah, I'm reminded of George Carlin's line that in America there's all sorts of choice and debate on things that are trivial and no choice and debate on anything that really matters.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. We've got one caller patiently waiting. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with David Roediger.
Yes, good afternoon, Professor. A simple question, but not a simple one. To what extent would you say that the new anti-Islamism or anti-Arabism represents the new anti-Semitism? Of course, the callers and the listeners all know that Arabic is a Semitic language. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you. David?
Well, I mean, I think that's a useful reminder of the range of anti-Semitism as a term. I also think that when you asked before about some of the ways that some of this, what my one son calls getting into the Wayback Machine when we talk about history, actually applies to the present, that the extent of anti-Islamic racism and its weddedness to religious prejudice is some of the research that I've just done has very interesting implications for that, I think, because I think that in a certain way, in liberal communities anyway, in university communities, the idea of religious intolerance doesn't get talked about, hasn't until 10 years ago gotten talked about very much. This film, the Sinatra film that I end the book with, sets out to discuss racial intolerance by instead talking about religious intolerance and anti-Semitism. And I was very unsympathetic to that because it removed black people from the plot of the film and still am in many ways. But the anti-Islamic thrust in this society now makes that film itself look a little bit differently and makes it say, well, yeah, but isn't there something to be said about taking religious intolerance as a serious political matter as well?
You know, with the second wave of immigration that began in the 1960s and certainly caught up speed in the 1970s in the United States, you know, we're going through a revolution of demography in this country today that's remaking it in ways that would make 1923 unrecognizable and certainly 1870 completely unrecognizable to where this country's going to be in 10, 20, 30 years, where we're rapidly moving toward. And we're going to have a very significant Latino population and Asian population. The traditional Northern European and Western European whites, to the extent you can even distinguish them due to intermarriage.
Right,
I don't even know if those terms mean anything. But where they might have been the vast majority of the people in 1865 in the United States, they're going to be a distinct minority if they aren't – they already are, but they're going to even be a smaller minority, except maybe in terms of economic power.
Yeah.
Where does whiteness play into all this in this changing environment where instead of being 80% of the population or 90% loosely defined as white at one time, it's going to be a much lower percentage and there's going to be a whole range of ethnic identities in the population?
Well, I'm not a person that believes that history repeats itself or that we can just find a lesson in the past. But one thing that I think is a generates some good questions about the new century that we've entered and the last century that most of us lived through is in the 1890s, there were these same kinds of fears that the United States was losing its racial character. There was constant, I would say, paranoic literature, including dates, just like we have these in 2047, mm-hmm. it'll be a majority non-white nation. You had exactly the same kind of predictions with dates in the 1890s. But the racial character that they were talking about was Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, mm-hmm. Racial character, Northern and Western Europe. And the racial threat was Southern and Eastern Europeans and, of course, African Americans also. And, you know, so when they totaled up these numbers, those would be lumped together. But then somewhere along the line, those Italians, Greeks, Portuguese, Poles, Eastern European Jews got reclassified as being fully part of the white mm-hmm. race. Mm-hmm. And so I think that when we look forward to the new century, it could be that this new demographic will produce an end to white supremacy or just make whiteness kind of irrelevant. But it could also be that whiteness will be reconfigured. And that's a political question. And that's where we get into the sense that whiteness is a political alliance. And if it pays off, and if it pays off for Cubans, for example, to think of themselves as white and to vote as white and to organize as white, you know, then I think we have a good chance that whiteness will survive into the middle of the 20th century. You don't really have to have a white majority to have a white supremacist society anyway. I mean, colonialism.
No, I think that, that's been proven.
Teaches us that. But if there's not much of a payoff in whiteness, if we can create a economically just society across racial lines, then I think that that kind of sense that there'll be a real strong attachment to white identity will recede, and the numbers will dictate that white supremacy erodes.
You know, David Roediger, we've only got a few minutes left, and you know, I had this ambitious list of topics we were going to talk about, including the chief and the effort to sort of have balance in the classrooms, as some people have said it, to purge the left-wing bias of professors. And I don't think we're going to have time to do justice to those two topics. But I think in the case of the chief, I'd like to turn to that if we could, simply because you've written about this. This has been an issue of concern of yours. We have a lot of listeners outside the area. Could you just give a little bit of background about what the chief issue is? I mean, for people in the area, it's sort of they know instantly when you say the chief what you're talking about. But what is this issue and what's at stake here?
Yeah, the University of Illinois, where Bob and I teach, has, as people will know from the NCAA basketball successes, has a team name called the Fighting Illini and a symbol, I would say mascot, of the team is Chief Illiniwek, a fictional Indian chief, in quotes, that's occupied this position since the 1920s. It was invented in the 1920s and has been fiercely opposed on campus for the last 15 years and by Native American activists nationally for a much longer time. In some ways, it's the lightning rod for opposition to racist mascots because it involves not only a symbol, but a college student, always white, who dresses up as an Indian and performs ersatz Indian dances at halftime of football games in particular and sometimes at basketball games as well. So this chief wearing kind of paraphernalia from tribal groupings, some not, and performing dances that are inauthentic in the extreme, occupies this central position, particularly in Illinois football, in which becomes the embodiment of what it means to be an Illini.
And so what is the status of the – I mean, there has been a campaign to remove the chief. What's the status of that now?
Well, over the last 2 years, there was a point that we thought we had the chief removed. Those of us who have been active in the anti-chief campaigns, there seemed to be a coalition in the Board of Trustees to replace the mascot, the chief, with another symbol. That fell apart, and now the board is undertaking what it calls a consensus process through which those who believe that the chief is inoffensive and important to Illinois heritage and team spirit will somehow agree with those who believe it's a racist symbol, and then there'll be some kind of a compromise based on that agreement. It's very, very unclear that that can happen.
What are the arguments of people who are proponents of keeping the chief that say they're not, it is not a racially based phenomenon? You know, what is the case for the chief that you hear?
Well,
I think
it involves the idea that the chief somehow keeps Indians in the public eye. There's, first of all, a sense that the mascot, the symbol itself, is revered and liked and loved, and so how could it have a negative connotation? So the so the argument goes. But then the more sophisticated case on those lines would say, if you get rid of the chief, then it's just another disappearance of Indians from public consciousness. Better to educate around the chief. Better to have the young person who impersonates the chief trained to engage in educational work, and that's a very kind of college-y solution to the problem. Except it again disregards Native opinion. It disregards the studies that record the detrimental impact of the chief and other racist mascots on Native youth. It sort of keeps everything in the hands of the white university and doesn't really move out of that framework.
David Roediger, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Please join us 1 week from today. We'll have another great show for you. We've only got a little bit of time left, David, and you know we're going to do this stuff on the left-wing bias of academics. We're going to do a whole show on that soon, and we'll get you back then. But I do want to ask you before we go, for people who have been listening to the show who are interested in staying on top of issues of race in society, can you recommend websites or sources for people who just want to immerse themselves in this, not academic stuff, but just sort of where would you look for interesting stuff?
Well, I think the best and kind of lively journal in this regard is the British Journal Race and Class. And the website Black Commentator is the most consistently broad and interesting website on race that I know about.
David Roediger, I hear the band tuning up in the background. You know what that means. We've got to clear out of the studio and let them in. But before we go, quickly, what are you working on now? What's your next project?
I have a book coming out next week called...
Another book? You know, 3 weeks ago? Isn't that...
History Against...
Balco's going to have to investigate you.
History Against Misery from Charles H. Kerr, and then I'm doing a short history of race in the United States.
What's that, in 5 weeks from now?
No, that's a long time.
Okay, David Roediger,
thanks
so much for being our guest. And listeners, thank you all. And I want to thank John Anderson for sitting in today, doing a great job pinch hitting for Andrew Boyle's producer. And be back in 167 hours.
That was fun.
This week in This American Life, Bob had a good job as an electrician. But he wanted to do something bigger. And he came up with an idea for an invention. Sat down with a bunch of physics books to see if it could work.
Of course, I never got to the invention because I found something else. It's something every Nobel Prize winning physicist missed.
It's something Einstein got wrong. It's something Newton got wrong. That is, if Bob's right.
Tonight at 6 here on WILL Urbana. A heat advisory is in effect for Champaign-Urbana until 7 o'clock tomorrow evening. This afternoon, very hot and humid with a high around 102 degrees and southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. The temperature and the humid air mass will combine to produce heat index values from 110 to 115 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear with a low in the mid-70s and southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Conditions will remain very humid overnight as well. It's 2 p.m., a Prairie Home Computer.